Catch new episodes of Dial the Gate weekends at youtube.com/dialthegate. And for the latest schedule, visit dialthegate.com. Welcome, everyone, to Dial the Gate. My name is David Reed. This is the Stargate Oral History Project. Patrick McKenna, Jay Felger himself, is joining us for this episode of the show. And we are live, so if you are in the YouTube chat, start submitting your questions to the mods. Before we get into that, if you enjoy Stargate and you want to see more content like this on YouTube, please click that like button. It makes a difference with YouTube and will continue to help the show grow its audience. Please also consider sharing this video with a Stargate friend. And if you want to get notified about future episodes, click the subscribe icon. And giving the bell icon a click will notify you the moment a new video drops, and you'll get my notifications of any last-minute guest changes. And clips from this live stream will be released over the course of the next few weeks on both the Dial the Gate and GateWorld.net YouTube channels. As this is a live stream, as I said before, my moderators are in the chat looking for questions for Patrick, which I will ask him in the second half of the show. So you got a little bit of time to warm up your thoughts there. In the meantime, he and I are going to spend some time getting to know each other. Patrick McKenna, Jay Felger, in Stargate SG-1. How you doing, sir?
I am doing great here on Earth. Much better.
How was your mission to Ball's planet? And thank you so much for restoring the dial home device and the Stargate network to its proper working order, as all galactic citizens deserve Stargate travel. So thank you for that.
Well, I do what I can, you know? I do what I can.
Oh, man.
Which doesn't seem to be a lot, unfortunately.
Okay, so I've got to back up. The first time I ever saw you, I'm in high school, and I'm in a rather eccentric instructor's class, and she puts on this thing called the Red Green Show. And I was like, why have I never seen this? I live in Southern Illinois. I live in a town of 5,000 people. A substantial number of that are proud rednecks. Why have I not come across this show? And it was just one of those things where it was like, you know, this is perfect. I mean, the bits, the duct tape, all of it. It was like, this is absolutely the perfect show. What was it like being a part of this thing for 15 years?
It was incredible because everybody seemed to react the way you're reacting, which is because it was a PBS show. So unfortunately, you didn't seem to watch PBS, David. But anyway, we're going to let that go. We're going to let
Bob Ross.
but that's where it was usually. So it was picked up by region by region. So those who saw it seemed to fall in love with it. So people in New York didn't get it. People in L.A. didn't get it. But in the Illinois area, down in Iowa, Ohio, like it was just killer, man. It was fantastic. And same up here. All Canadians are pretty much that way, except Toronto and Vancouver.
Yeah.
So they didn't get it much either. So we're really a central type show. So for 15 years, man, we just had so much fun of blowing stuff up and running around. And we'd come down and do shows and people would be dressed up like us. And, you know, baseball stadiums of 5,000 people dressed like our characters. They really... Audiences are amazing when they enjoy a show. It's fantastic.
What do you think?
And a Stargate's the same way.
Well, that's fair. It's just like different types of audiences, but they're all feeding into it very similarly. What do you think it is about shows like these that capture the cultural zeitgeist where if they get broadcast? It's important for the game. Yeah. What is it about? What do you think it? Let's start with Red Green. What do you think it was about that show that was? That kept it on the air for 15 years. What was so endearing about it? And I have some my own thoughts as well, having since watched more of the show.
Sure. Well, I think a lot of it was that we kept it really simple. Yeah. You know, the idea would start small and would get out of control for us. And I think everybody could buy into that. They'd watch the thing unfold in front of them, which was easy to watch. And there was a lot of people that were, as I said, like the big cities didn't get into it because they weren't city concerns. They were more rural concerns. So there was a whole audience that didn't get to see that type of show. so that when they saw it, they started buying into it like crazy because it actually spoke to them. And it came out in the 90s. So like Seinfeld was big and Cosby and all these type of things. So that was the type of show that was out there for everybody to watch. And if you weren't into that, there wasn't a lot. So suddenly a voice like ours came through and it was like, oh, there we go. That's really nice. And you see things like Sunny in Philadelphia started to take off and smaller ideas seemed to plug into the indie television, seemed to catch on a little bit there. And I guess maybe we were part of that wave, which was really, really nice.
Yeah.
It was also that every week was the same show. There was nothing current in it. There was no news, no nothing. You could watch the first episode and the last episode, and it's pretty much the same show. And that was sort of the goal, is let's just keep it to the lodge. It just stays at what happens at the lodge stays at the lodge.
Do you miss Harold?
Quite a bit. Yeah. I mean, I still get a lot of recognition, a lot of calls for him because it was such a popular show up here in Canada that it plugged in a different way. It's very nice that way. So I do miss him in the sense that it allowed you to be completely silly and zany twice a week in front of an audience and get paid for it, which was just glorious. You know,
what do you take away with you from that experience of working on a production for that long with a character who just had, you know, a heart of gold, wore his emotions on his sleeve? You know, there's to be able to connect with an audience like that has got to be something really special.
It's nice. I think the advantage of the character was that he was vulnerable in a room of men like that. And oftentimes I was the representative of a wife in a relationship.
Yeah.
You know, because Red Green used to do a show called Smith and Smith with his wife. It was very Sonny and Cher like. So when she stopped doing television, I kind of filled that role for him. So we could still have that kind of banter that a husband and wife might have in a stand-up situation. And I got to be that position for, when I got mail, it was always from the wives, always from the sisters and the children. It was like, that's my uncle. That's my dad. It was always, I'm you and he's somebody else to me. And that was, so being vulnerable, I always carried that going, I won't be offended. I'm never offended by Uncle Red. I'm just like, I let it bounce off and move on, which I always thought was a strong way, the message to send out. If I'm going to be the vulnerable person, not to be hurt by everything, right, to take it, laugh along, enjoy the moment and put it aside, acknowledge that people don't think like me and just go, oh, well, move on. So that was sort of my role that I tried to reinvent every week, was how to stay afloat amongst all these men.
And also a certain amount of respecting your elders.
Exactly. Exactly. That was a big part of that era. You know, that Steve, who wrote the show, played Red Green. He did most of the writing. And that's really his background. And it's very much like that. Respect your elders and pay attention. You may think they're wrong, but you're going to go along with the idea until you get the I told you so moment. Every kid loves the I told you so moment.
Well, every once in a while, you know, they do have a right idea every now and then. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about getting Stargate. Had you seen the show before? How aware of it were you?
Well, at the time, I was living out in Vancouver, so I was very aware of the show because my friend Gary Jones works in the show. So Gary and I were friends for years, and he got the show, and it was like, oh, wonderful, congratulations. And that was great, and I was moving up back to Toronto. And the minute you make plans to leave somewhere, that's when you get a job. And, of course, they offered me with those guys. The other guys came up. And so that was like, oh, okay, this is terrific. And it was a comedy team thing, which I love. I mean, I have that from the Red Green background. I kind of knew how to respond with the person specifically and share it with the room, which was great. But John Billingsley, first time we met, was on set that day. And it was just like, oh, we're going to have so much fun because has an improv background like I do. So the two of us could just laugh and play along. And quite a few of the lines that we made up stayed in the show, which was a lot of fun.
Okay.
A lot of times they don't do that, you know.
I think he was working on Enterprise at that point, if I'm not mistaken. He had already started that, so he's already got like the sci-fi like churning through his blood. So
it's absolutely,
that's wild.
And he brought that with him, which is great because there was a whole group of fans of the show that week were on set from Britain. And they were just thrilled because they knew John from the other program as well. They were just very sci-fi buffs. They knew it all. So he was like the star of the room, the fact that he was in two shows.
Right, exactly. Tell me about who was Jay to you? Who was this
Jay
guy?
To me, He was a guy who, like, if they had, if they worked on the 12th floor, he was on like the third floor, you know. It was just so far. Maybe he might see them in the cafeteria, maybe in the lobby, you know. Just those, that's why we're all here, is for those guys. And I just really played up that hero worship like crazy of, you know, he's the star football player in high school. He's the guy that if I could stand next to, everyone's going to like me. You know, he was everything. Seeing those guys, it'd be like being accepted by them would be, oh, this is wonderful for Jay. Because he was always that guy that kind of pushed out of the circle. He wasn't the cool guy. He was science nerd, tripping over his own feet. I always like to think of a character at about 12 to 15 and then put them in an adult body and see what happens. You know, that's socially, you're so awkward at that time. You're just, everything's racing through your mind. You think it's all about you. You're so, you know, aware. And I always find that's a good place to start, is like, how would this person react as a teen? And then, you know, what would you tell yourself 20 years from now? And then I can build on that. And he, and it was so much fun that way, because they were such a family, you know, that the all the performers. So it was so easy to be that guy on the outside of that family and just to be a sycophant to each and every one of them, because I was a fan of the show and it was truly a gift to be on set with them. You know, my son was such a MacGyver fan, watching the escalation of this was like, you know what I'm doing today? I'm working with MacGyver in a new world.
Literally.
He was so young. Yeah, literally. Exactly. So it was, everything about it was kind of easy for me to fall into. And then the script was so good. It was just so much playing, and I love that. I mean, I could just picture Martin and Lewis on that other planet doing this stuff. I could picture Abbott and Costello there doing it, you know? So for John and I to be dropped there was like, we got this. We're going to have so much fun. And Martin Wood, the director, was just lapping every offer we made. And he'd go, too much, and we wouldn't do it. And then he'd go, perfect, and we would play along with that. And a lot of little things he just kind of let us do, you know?
I'm really glad to hear that you were allowed to feel things out with the material and kind of dial it around, you know, in front of the camera to make it, you know, exactly the way that you wanted it.
Well, and the way they wanted it too, because I have to fit in their universe, you know, and being a guest in the world, sometimes, you know, you don't know how thick the ice is in certain areas where you can stand. And there'd be times I'd be like, well, I'm going to try it like this. And they go, you know, not really. We want more of this. We know we saw that before in this other show with this character. We need this. And it's like, oh, okay, great. And they were really gentle about nuancing Jay to be bumbling, but not so much so that we wouldn't believe he couldn't do his job ever. You know, so that he needed that element too of he could get there. He just had to get there himself.
That's it. Exactly. And the other part of it is, and I'm curious to know if this, I'm sure it occurred to you, but maybe it didn't. I mean, you're representing the fans in this character in some respect, because he's a fan of SG-1, just like the audience is a fan of SG-1. If they've stuck around for six seasons, was that playing into your mental process doing this, or was it just, no, the show's not real. I'm in this. I mean, the show is real. Yeah. I'm in the world.
I think that's a part of the responsibility that comes with it. But if you play it honestly and specifically to the, just to the character, then that will reveal itself. Cause I didn't necessarily know or feel I was the audience rep. I was just Jay's rep, and he becomes the reflection of all that. That's similar to the Harold character in Red Green, is if I play it for the audience only, then I'm not totally in that moment with them. They just have to find themselves within that moment too. And if I'm playing it honestly, they should see that emotion, if that's what they tap into, hopefully, that makes people connect. It's the vulnerability of that moment, the awkwardness, or the hero worship. There's so many different emotions floating around with Jay. There was a lot of things you could grab onto and go for the ride, which I hope they found.
No, absolutely. I think that everyone has had a fantasy, you know, here or there about rescuing Captain Kirk. You know, or whoever your analog for Captain Kirk is, you know, in a different situation. Yeah. And so he gets to execute that. But at the end of the day, it's an interesting choice that was worked into the episode, because O'Neill is not thrilled by scientists. Never has been.
No.
They don't listen to him.
No.
So he has some justification there. But it was really it was a huge departure from the show, because we're pulling back the veil a little bit, just a little bit of fourth wall breaking, not a lot, but just enough to say, you know what, we're going to play with this character for this sequence of events and this kind of preposterous situation for this episode. Stargate was really good about once a season of doing this with a character.
Yeah.
And I think that it worked out pretty well, because it could have fallen flat on its face. You know, if you're watching this and it's like, or you're doing the material, it's like, we've got to make sure that we get this right, because we're awfully on the nose about this, the circumstances of this situation, about the scientist who's going to be saving the lives of the heroes for a change.
But yeah, and it had to be a very nerdy scientist, because it couldn't be anybody more heroic than them. Otherwise, show changes. You know,
that's it. Becomes, we start one of watching that scientist. Him. That's it.
Exactly. You know, and I wouldn't mind that. You know, that'd be okay. Felger in space, you know. But that's the function oftentimes when you're the guest star for the week is, you know, you're raised up high, but you're not forever. So right. you know that for sure, too. You know that going in as well. So no matter what heroic or misstep you take, the world will come back to normal by the end of the 60 minutes.
Aside from Billingsley, do you have any memories from that first episode?
Yeah. When you get to be backstage a little bit, it was so much fun. Like the weight of the costumes, you know, like they're made out of rubber tires, you know, the Jaffa. So it's like, that's really heavy stuff. So my respect for the background performers wearing it all day and running and fighting, you go, oh, that's good on you guys. This stuff is really heavy to wear. So that was fun. I remember at one point, the one guy came up and he said, something, why are you here? And something like that. And I impersonated his voice back going, well, we are blah, 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 blah. And
he is
that
sick.
Wasn't in the script.
I think it's something he ate.
Yeah, he is something like that. Yeah, he is sick. But I was just basically having fun with that actor's delivery. So, you know, afterwards, Martin said, that's hilarious. We're keeping that. And it was like, oh, okay. So that became the thing. And I don't think the poor actor knew that basically I was impersonating him, you know, like with his delivery. Why are you here? Well, we are. So things like that I remember, because they would celebrate fun moments of things. Like when we landed in the stars, the gate, I would have all crunched up in a ball, like, because I had no idea where we were going to land or how we were going to land. I never done this before. So when they said in action and I curled up in the ball, they had to do it a couple of times because the crew was dying laughing, because it was like no one arrives in a new world that way. They all come in superhero. You know? Here's a guy who's almost going to wet his pants right away. You know, so it's things like that. They were just like, have fun and just keep going. And the sets were great. The sets were incredible. You know, it really was a genre piece. You know, it felt like we're playing a genre of you know, the Bowery Boys, Abbott and Costello. There's a, you know, this one is a fun episode. So it had to stay in there, but the world was like, yes, it's real. This is all happening. We're going to do this, but these are not the guys who should be doing it. Oh no. That in itself is the oh no of the episode, you know?
No, these are the guys that keep the power running, you know, and are yeah. making sure that everything is working properly. But sometimes,
oh no, it's Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson at the nuclear plant.
The nuclear plants, absolutely. But sometimes I think the thing that I love about it is that in our lives we are sometimes called to adventure, and not all of us may necessarily be as gung-ho as Jay is about it. It's not necessarily the first line of thought. It's like, well, we don't leave our people behind, so we're here to rescue you.
Right. Yeah.
But I think as an audience member, don't count yourself out for an opportunity for adventure. You know, don't risk.
It was interesting that way, because it's also that world where everyone was telling Jay he was wrong. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. And it was once something within him was still, I'm running towards the fire as opposed to away from it. There was something that is heroic in him to want to be able to do that, but never being able allowed to nurture that. And this was that moment that it was just somewhat unstoppable for him, that he had to follow that. And I think that's a very strong message as well. When everyone around you was telling you're wrong, but you're inside feel you have to do something. It was nice to be able to follow through on that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we sometimes just know what we have to do. And, I think that in terms of a takeaway from that episode, there's nothing wrong with having heroes and emulating them, especially if they're, you know, saving the world week after week. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, and accepting the fact that you're a spoke in the wheel and it needs every spoke to turn, you know, so that was sort of the reward in the end. I knew I wasn't going to be part of the team, but I was for a while. I was an important spoke, and I'll go back to what I was doing. But, you know, I got kissed, you know, I got thanked, I got praised. It was a great moment for Jay, you know, and then back to work. The holiday's over.
That's absolutely. It's kind of part of me was like, you know, it's a fantasy in the end. Or do you think that parts of that were real?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I was just reading that in some of the notes and so on, that some people really thought it was a daydream, the whole experience. I never really thought of it that way. I played it all out, you know, and there was parts within it that were his daydreams. But to me, that was the moment. I never looked at it that way. It was an interesting perspective.
Well, it's definitely real because Harak, the first Prime, appears later on in the show. So there were debates when that came out. It's like that didn't really happen. It's not just the Carter smooching him at the end. That's the fantasy. It's the whole thing. And like no, there's characters introduced in this thing that play out later. So he really did that.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing too. Yeah, because I think that confirmed it as well as coming back for Avenger. Yeah. It's like, well, then that means the other guys had to happen.
That's it. Tell us about Avenger 2.0.
That was a very different one in that coming back for Avenger. Yeah, because when they say, oh, you know, we're having Jay come back, it's like, oh, great. So I assumed it was going to be very similar to the first type of episode. And it was like, okay. Then so I walked around looking for John, in case, you know, on set going, no, John's not coming this time. It's just you. It's like, oh, okay. This is a very different experience. And the way they had me working more with Amanda mm-hmm. was just fantastic. You know, it's like, and then seeing Jay at home. the stuff Jay at home was very much, this is your apartment, Patrick, what do you want to do? So it was like, well, okay, I'm going to be in my underwear, I'm going to be this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to be all that stuff, was sort of just working it out. Like putting my pants on backwards was totally like something I just did on the set, like when they did it, and I put it on as a joke backwards, and then the rest of the scene I'm trying to do my pants up from behind, you know, with a woman in the room that she won't notice that my pants are on backwards. Like all those things, like how can we add conflict to everything that Jay tries? It's got to be some kind of hurdle. And they were so great with that. And then they had the gentle scene at the bridge with Amanda again, to see the vulnerability and the stress that he's really trying, and he's screwed up, and he's responsible for so much of this mess, he believes, and he doesn't know how to fix it. And he's letting everybody down, particularly his heroes.
Yeah.
So the weight of what Jay had to go through was far more severe this time than the first time. It was more action, more reaction. This one was up to me from the very beginning, and I messed it up.
Well,
so it was.
It's so much more of it is it's like the first episode is really about, you know, being a fish out of water. This one is really kind of like Stargate at the Office in terms of an episode. Like what happens when your day-to-day job is one that deals with people going to and from leaving the planet in your office building, and you do something that absolutely destroys that work environment. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, it shows again, you know, the times we're in, how vulnerable things are. Right. It doesn't take a lot to throw things off kilter.
No.
You know, so Jay happened to be that example of the time, you know, and it was so exciting that they wanted Jay to help, but they didn't want Jay to help, you know, like they knew they needed him. So there was a great, he could worm his way into things, you know, well, sir, I volunteer to go. And it's like, you know, we should go together. Yes. Yeah. That's what we should do. That right away of whatever gets me there, I'm fine. You know, let's just do this. Let's do it again. Not thinking any further than I'm going, you know,
he still wants to do his part. No. Yeah. I love Carter's line. Yes, he's a screw up, but he's a brilliant scientist. That's why he's there, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that it's okay to accept that you can be both, you know, as long as you're trying to improve yourself day in and day out.
Yeah,
accept your starting position, you know.
Yeah,
to a certain degree,
and recognize that people do accept that. I mean, she listed all the faults with Jay, but she also, as you say, concluded with, but he's a brilliant scientist. You know, it's like, that's what they appreciate in you. There's something they also appreciate. So that's something to find sometimes in any human being is they like this. I'm not a total loser, total waste. I'm right. This, you know, and that's an important thing too. And then Jay gets the opportunity to prove himself over and over again.
Probably my favorite moment in that episode is the phone call with Mom. No, don't get me wrong. I love the explosions and everything else, but there is a scene there that shows this guy, hasn't always been properly nurtured. And there are forces in his life that to this day still think that he's not worth being, you know, where he is. And Sam overhears that. And she's like, okay, I think that was like part of the pivot point for this episode is like, I got to try it this way with this guy because it's just a matter of motivation. And so many of us, you know, in dealing with other people in our day-to-day lives, we know that they can do something. We know that they can. But how to motivate them is the trick. It's not easy.
No, especially if you recognize where they're wounded or how they're wounded and not trying to push any buttons on that. You know, we try not to. And sometimes that's very difficult because you don't know what those buttons are with people. The triggers can be anything. You know, so it's a very difficult time, especially for men right now to be very gentle with our words and think ahead of time. And it's a very different time to be plugged into community.
Yeah, absolutely. The I love that the character has continued to resonate with so many fans. And I'm sorry that I've taken so long to have you on to discuss him. So I'm really happy that we're talking about him now. Do you have?
I was also in Avenger. They did that nice little nod to Red Green. They put pick up the duct tape first and put it in my bag. That was definitely, they set that out there. The prop guys put it there, and I went, "Oh, duct tape." They went, "Yeah, duct tape, man. It's for you." You notice the shot starts on the duct tape, and there's my hand putting it in. It's like. They really, you know, those who know that's a little nod to Red Green right there. And then that was one of my favorite scenes because that education that Chloe was in love with him, that kind of was a moment. It's like, he's been in the office for how long with this person and didn't pick up on these things? There was a lot of nice opportunities for Jay to grow and to be a human and to be more confident with himself by the end of this episode, which I thought was a really nice climb. And you know, and that being probably the last show I was going to do with them, it was a really nice conclusion for Jay. I was very happy with that. Comfortable, that character is very comfortable in whatever world he's in now.
Absolutely. Maybe with Chloe, you know, office romances are, I love that exchange between the two of them where he said, you know, you don't know what it's like to you know, not have someone that you care about pay any attention to you. And she's like, yeah, well, you know.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's happening right in front of him. He didn't get it. So it's a typical
the
guy.
Scripts are so good.
Yeah.
Man, the writing is good in that show. So tight.
Amanda Tapping. Tell me about working with
her. She was so grand because I didn't realize at the time she was she's getting into the directing as more so than had directed. So her eye was so keen. And her within the script, she was already breaking it down ahead of time. Just watching her work with the script was so fascinating. And because I was going to be with her, she would become the new lead. So everything setting up for her, how do we set her up to be the hero and set me down? And she was way ahead of that, where you don't have to kind of fight with other actors to kind of go, well, this moment would work if I did this. She was way ahead of that. Like, I just had to follow her lead, man. She was in charge of everything. It was so easy to work with her. Because you could trust everything she was doing. She helped me on certain, you know, like angles of lay down here, kick your leg up so the camera knows you're there. There's just during the fight scenes, I was getting lost. And she just little things she would help me with that, you know, no one knew about. It was just her being wonderful.
She's not an actress who crowds people out, you know. She's one who brings you in and makes sure that, you know, you're where you should be.
Yeah. And I think that really pays off in her directing because she knows the story we're here to tell and just this much of it right now, we're not telling the whole story. It's a little puzzle piece. We're going to do a scene and she keeps it so compact and so focused that then the picture just becomes so typically clear by the end. She was fantastic to work with. I haven't had a chance to work with her as a director yet. I'd really love to see more of that.
Absolutely. What, in terms of looking back on the legacy of this character, what do you hope fans take away about Jay in terms of the aspects that they see themselves in him, not necessarily going to other planets, but in like social situations and, you know, in dealing with people that you respect and admire? What do you hope that people took from this role?
I think acceptance, really, that the group's acceptance of Jay, Jay's acceptance of himself, Chloe's acceptance of the relationship. Everyone had to, you know, accept something and then move on by their experience with Jay. And I found that very empowering. You know, whether you are the cool group and the nerd wants in and you're not letting him in, acceptance. You know, you're the nerd who's not getting in, it's okay. Acceptance. You know, there was a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I've got some fan questions for you.
Oh, great.
So Summer, you just met Summer a moment ago. She says, since you played substantially smart, socially awkward characters before, did you see Felger as anything like Harold in Red Green or Marty in Traitors? Or was he completely his own blank slate when you approached him? Did
when
you
I
carry
approached
stuff
him, he was...
over like subconsciously even?
I'm sure I do. Watching the show over again, I kind of went, oh, there's a Haroldism right there. But it's because that's how my instrument delivers that energy, that line. It's like, oh, there's crossovers because it's me delivering it. So I sometimes make more effort now to make sure I don't laugh a certain way or point to certain, like there's certain things that are tip into that because that just what came naturally after 15 years of doing that show. So there's a couple moments in there where you bring it in. But mostly Jay to me was an everyman. You know, he was just an everyman, where the other two were kind of extremes, whereas Jay was sort of floating in the middle. He was a chameleon. Like, who do you want me to be? Who do you want me to be? Who do you need me to be? And I'll be that person. You know, and he's very needy, which is something I like to bring to characters anyway, because Harold was needy and so was Marty. Like, everybody kind of wants to be liked and wanted. And I find that's a good emotion to work from for a character. So certainly Jay was like that.
Well, there's a nervous energy there that's fun to watch. I mean, someone with a comedy background, you know, he kind of get your kicks out doing that. So it's like,
very
you don't
know
which direction he's going to explode in.
Yeah. You know, and because they did the genre stuff, and I am such a big comedy nerd, that it was like, okay, I love doing this show. I love it. The opportunities they give Jay to be ridiculous yet confident. It was, and I got to kiss another girl in it. You know, it's like,
right.
My wife goes
right.
Crazy
in
going,
the fantasy.
What is
he gets
it with
the girl
you kissing the girl?
I'm sorry, I spoke. Spoke over. What did your wife
no,
say?
I'm just saying Jay gets all the girls. It's like, you know, it's not a bad message either. You know, the meek and herald inherit the world and herald the world.
Oh, jeez.
There's my T-shirt.
Oh, that's funny. Melissa Smith, does a particular episode stand out to you because of what the episode contained or funny bits happening within certain scenes of certain people? Were there any juicy scenes in these two shows that really stood out?
For me, the one I had the most fun with was the in Avenger, the gunfight scene. Was because it was just running around blowing things up and this and that. But the end when Richard Dean came in and they would say, oh, now you go over and you know, be excited that he's there. I never told Richard I was going to hug him, you know? So it was one of those things of, I just ran over and I just grabbed him as big as I could. And what you see is actually Richard reacting to get off, get away, doing the whole Three Stooges thing. Like, he caught on immediately of this. And that whole struggle in there was just us doing that of, this guy's going to attack me with a hug if Richard doesn't push him back.
And you go after him again. That was funny.
Every take, I went after him differently. And he didn't know which way I was going to do. One time I climbed on him like a monkey. I had my legs wrapped around him and my arms. I almost dragged him to the ground. I did it maybe 6-7 times. And you could just see Richard was kind of like, he wasn't working with me that episode, right? So he was kind of like, is this guy for real? What's going on here? I could see he was having enough of me. There's a certain point going, all right, Patrick, choose one and stick with it.
That's fun. Enough but of you. You may not know this, but Rick is known for throwing curveballs to people on that set. Like,
oh, yeah.
Lines of dialogue and doing things. And he's waiting for their reaction to see if they're going to break while the camera's rolling or if they're going to swallow it and just keep on moving. So to hear this from my perspective, this is glorious because he's getting his comeuppance. But you, the comedy pro that you are throwing things right back at another comedy genius and saying, hey, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
That's funny, Patrick.
Yeah, it was great. And because they didn't say, you know, just go over and thank him. They said, keep that going. You know, like those are the moments that's what you're on a great set when they just go, that would work. Breathe into that as opposed to, nope, stop. We have a world created and you don't create anything else in it. It's like, nope, they were wide open to this is huge. This is big. Go for it. You know, you're a silly man. Have some fun. That one stood out for me because watching react every time was so fun because I knew he was really uncomfortable.
Well, it's true to the character. You know, you're being... Yeah. You're finding the truth in the character in that moment. That's his hero. This is a person whom he loves. You know, this is a guy he'd walk over hot coals. He went into battle for this guy. So
and he saved him. You came back for me. This is so great. I thought we were done for and everything else. And I thought it was great too the way Jay just completely dumps Amanda and just runs.
It's true.
Everything was great with her for a second, but it's like, no,
O'Neill's here. Whack. Out of the way.
Exactly.
I'm coming through.
Cher's here. Sorry, Sonny. You know,
that's funny.
Those moments made me laugh too. Of he's just so in that moment of who, what he needs, what he wants, how excited. But that whole episode was so much fun because coming back, they were excited I was there to allow me to do things. So that was great. And the first one was just, again, the fun of playing that genre, which nobody's doing anymore. So as an actor, you get that spot going, oh my goodness, I get to make one of these. This is great.
That's great. David Hewlett.
Oh no.
Is in the audience.
Uh-oh.
How do we join the Patrick McKenna fan club? How do you not age? Is it possible that I am aging for you? Please send him a big sloppy kiss and hug too. So here's the hug and here's the kiss from David Hewlett.
Oh, David Hewlett, how fantastic. David, we worked on Traitors together. And oh my goodness. And his sister, Kate, did a show up here that I worked with too. He's, absolutely. That family is just so talented. Yep. David, if you're listening, I love you, miss you, pal. You're just he's the best, the best.
The talent that Stargate Productions acquired to make up the foundation of 17. There's no question why the franchise ran for 17 seasons. It had
absolutely
compelling characters and people we loved watching. So I mean,
they really did it well where the crew was so tight and who they were and that we knew that family that you could bring anything to that family. You could bring comedy to them. You could bring drama, adventure, and they had someone who was able to handle that moment very well. And that was the beauty of the show. I think you could bring anything to them, you know, and sometimes like Bob Newhart, does the comedy come to him or is he the comedy? You know, like crazy people come to Bob. And I found that with the crew too, like the worlds come to them, even though they go to them, the world has to be there for them to experience, you know? So that's always a different thing too.
The amount of content that those people had to put out week in and week out, there is kind of like where's the chicken or the egg, you know, which came first, because they have to constantly create not just a new environment but a whole new planet week after week, and it's like how do you get that across, you know, without in some seasons 40 episodes. That team did 40 episodes a year. How do you not just have your head just fall off?
Oh, it's incredible the work they do. It's a week, and it's usually you see a lot of the same writers, you know, so it's the world is pretty darn tight. It's amazing. But it was one of the best sets I've ever been on because so many of them came from MacGyver right on to SG-1. So some of these people have been together 20 years. You know, they've seen children born and people pass and marriages and divorces. It was such a comfortable place to walk into as well. but I think they felt they could also trust any department to excel, whether it was props or set design. You know, that each one was incredibly important. Again, going back to the spoke element, how many spokes in that wheel turned every week for that many seasons? It was an amazing place.
Lock Watcher, you were in episodic television in Traitors, Red Green. What are the responsibilities of being a main as opposed to the guest star in the other guys in Avengers? How as an actor, where do your energies come in from week to week, knowing that you're saddled with a show, churning out episode after episode, as opposed to coming in and playing with a new team for a couple of shows? Like, where are your really responsibilities and energies? How do you get into that?
Each one is a different responsibility and comfort zone. Like, I found when I was doing the show week to week, really easy to do the character, really easy to memorize lines, because it was just, you were flowing naturally. Mm. And I remember watching guest stars going, boy, they're really good. I'm going to have to remember how tight they are, because it's almost like double Dutch skipping on a show. Yeah. And then you got to come in and double Dutch skip with them. They've been doing it for 20 years, and now you got to do it at the same rhythm and speed as them. So it's much harder to be a guest star that way, because it's much easier to trip up. when you are these guys, it's not so bad. You know the rhythm, you know how to dance, you know how to move next. And your responsibility within the group too. Am I the funny guy? Am I the smart guy? Am I the science guy? Am I the nerd? Am I the sexy one? Am I the, you know, afraid of one? Who am I within? What spoke am I in that wheel as well? And that's your responsibility week to week. So each one brings a different set of luggage that you have to bring with you. I find being in a show as a regular fantastic, because now your character is growing over 15 seasons, over 10 seasons. You know, you don't get that in a movie. You get 2 hours, you know. So that's always great. And as a guest star, it's the one in time. You've come in fully explored, and you're dropping in this moment and moving on again. Maybe to prison, maybe to death, who knows, but you're moving on. So each one comes with a different set of suitcases that you have to bring with you on the day. When I say to actors, though, if you're going to call sheet and you're number one, there's a certain energy as number one that you have to carry. That's a lot of responsibility. Do you blow up on a set, or do you laugh on a set? Do you go right back to your dressing room? Do you converse? It all comes from number one, and then how that energy comes. I love being number four or five, because one, two, and three are usually the heroes of the show. So they're going to be the same every week to some degree. Their choices, what they can do. Four, five, and six, that's where the writers get interesting, because it's like they can do all the stuff that the heroes can't do. They can cause the trouble. They can come up with the weird ideas. They can do this. They can do. So I like those ones, because that's more where I fit in, of maybe a troublemaker, maybe a new idea, where I don't have to be the same every week.
Well, you facilitate story.
Exactly. That's a nice place to be down there in those numbers. People go, oh, you know, number one is a huge responsibility, and you're going to be the same every week. And if you're in some type of show, that can be a very difficult bag to carry. If you're an adventure, it's great because you're doing something different. But, you know, courtroom drama is number one. Boy, that's a lot of lingo you're going to be memorizing.
Oh, man. And responsibility, for sure.
Exactly. So. Yeah. I've been on sets with bad number ones and sets with great number ones. And that's where I learned it really does trickle down from there. The crew reacts to it. Everybody reacts. The director is feeding it, being defensive to it. It all comes from that energy.
Stargate was a big production, and you've done a lot of work. Where did it stand in terms of your barometer for professionalism, for quality, you know, for communication between people, exchange of ideas, flexibility? Where does it stand in terms of your pantheon of content that you've worked on, your body of content?
I really don't say this lightly. It's number one. It really is, because they had been working together for so long. The machine was working so well. Call sheets were there, pickups were there, drivers were there, cast was on time, scripts were delivered, changes were delivered, emails were received. It never an issue whatsoever. It was just smooth. And as I said, when you step on set, there's this family already going, and you're just another guest who's welcome to stay for Sunday dinner, you know. And then it really was, and it was universal, you know, in the sense of the production company had enough money to make everybody comfortable. I was in a wonderful hotel. Wonderful per diems, restaurants. They took care of me with here's something you can do at night if you like to go out, or this or that. And It was really, really well done. And because they had that advantage of working so long, they had those legs to stand on, whereas a lot of the productions oftentimes, it's one season, it's a movie, they're going to hit and run and move on. So things can be a little sloppy around the edges. It'll pay off when we're done. They didn't have time for that. It was like, no, this has to be shot. We got another one next week and another one next week.
It's a
So it was
huge
very
machine and it's
tight.
not slowing down.
No,
So.
you have to come prepared. That's another thing too. There's no, I don't know my lines. And there's a lot of space talk that you got to learn sometimes that,
Space
me
talk, it's
learning
true.
gold was, forever. They're like, no, I go, gold, no, gold, no, gold, no. And it was really like, oh my goodness, it's a made up language. Who cares? Everybody cares. That's who cares.
That's
They know how to say
right.
it. That
Wow.
was my reminder of, no, you're the guest. Everyone else is here knows exactly this world. It's Gould. Say it properly. It's like, took a long time.
Gold.
Yeah, it was amazing. Oh, okay. They have
Wow.
respect for the worlds they create too.
Yeah, absolutely. Teresa MC, is there a character or a role that you would like to tackle that you haven't yet? Theater,
I would,
staged, film.
yeah, I would love to play a like a preacher, a minister, a Baptist minister. I think would be something. I do a lot of for some reason this instrument that I have comes across as car salesman, extroverted type people a lot, and it's like that's one I haven't had yet. Was I love to let me see if I can do it en masse, if I can turn this Irish charm on for mass appeal. Let's see if that would be good.
I would like to see that.
I would try that. But otherwise, I mean, I try to, there's a lot of offers. Being my age now, I've had a lot of opportunities to play different roles. That's why I had to pause because I've had some fantastic roles. But there's a few that I won't do. I won't do pedophiles. I won't do rapists. I won't do people who harm other people. That's just, I say no right up to that. And people, wouldn't it be great to see Harold as a murderer? It's like, maybe in a 1 hour show I would, but never children. I'm never going to hit a woman. I'm never going to hurt somebody that's lesser than me. I've been playing opposite that for my entire career, so I'm not going to start doing opposite that now. So those are about the only characters I won't do.
There's a certain amount of letting them under your skin that you have to do in order to get them to work.
That's
And
the thing that people don't seem to understand is like as an actor, your job is to justify. So if I have to justify those thoughts, I don't want to. I don't want to go there. I don't think it's necessary. I don't find it entertaining. So that's a place I don't like to go to because if I have to play it honestly, then you have to play it honestly. And that's a pretty horrible world to have to kind of drop into for a while. And as a father and a husband and a son, everything about it was like, I can't do this honestly. I'm not committed to it. I'm hiding, I'm backing away from it. So that tells me that I'm not doing the best job. Someone else should probably do this.
Yeah, if you're not going to be able to render it justice, and on top of that, you don't necessarily want those thoughts. So, yeah, if you
No,
have to
I
justify it,
don't.
that makes a lot of sense. If you have to justify, you're not just reading lines. You're
No.
inhabiting, a persona.
And that's to me is the simplest explanation of acting is to justify the script. Make that line make sense. Why are you saying it? What's it going to do? Justify why you're doing that. And then it just becomes much easier to do that. And in doing so, you also challenge the character. Why would he think that? Why would he say that? You discover the character by challenging yourself to justify every line that he's thinking or doing, trying to get in the writer's head to see where they were when they were trajecting this character. Because as an when you read the script, sometimes you go, "Oh, that's going to be a good one. I get to be, I get to wear cool clothes in that one, and I get to do that." Sometimes you forget the message that you're, transmitting throughout the script, especially in well-written scripts. You got to respect it's a well-written script and look for that underneath the line. Maybe there's something there that I'm not reading,
I really appreciate those thoughts, Patrick, because it's not necessarily saying that this is isn't an important part to play or an important story that needs to be told, but your talent, your facilities don't justify this. They don't fit into this box. And that's okay,
Yeah. Because when I started acting and I had an older actor tell me, he goes, just think of yourself that you're in an orchestra. And sometimes they need a French horn, sometimes they don't. When they call for the French horn, be ready to play.
Yeah.
But don't assume it's in every song. And that was a great analogy for me to kind of carry that sometimes I'm a French horn. I'm unique. And sometimes I'll be called upon. And a lot of times I won't. I may say, do you need this sound? I'll go to an audition going, I'm a French horn. And going, oh, we love French horns, but not in this song. We'll call you back, French horn.
Sooner or later. That's
eventually we'll need a French horn.
That's
And it saves me a lot of time going, that's okay. I'm not going to carry grief about I didn't get that gig or this or that. It's they didn't need what I present.
Life's too short.
Way too short. And there's a lot of projects that do and others don't. So it's all good.
Tune Tamasha. This is a nice one to finish on, I think. Tune Tamasha wants to know, Patrick, do you have a place where you go clear your mind to feed the ducks, as it were?
Actually, you know, yes. I bought it a few years ago and I'm living in it now, but because I was living in the city and it was one of those things, I got hurt in an accident. And it was one of those of, if I get out of this, I'm changing my life and I'm going to go move up to the country and just live my life. So I was got out of the hospital and I was able to do that. And I've come up here and I just live my life now. I sort of semi-retired. I pick work when I want it. Just, it's a much easier way to do things. So I'm at my pond.
Ah, okay. Yeah. You know, I'm in a similar situation in my life. I just turned 40 a couple of months ago, and I think
you're a kid.
I know.
Trust me, you're a kid. You think it's a lot right now? I am the future, David. I am your future. Look at, see the beard? See this?
Yeah. Okay.
This is you, my son.
But I think it's important to it sounds like you said that you had an accident that was your pivot point to assess where you are with the people you're with in your life, and make sure that you always have a quiet place for yourself, and to always fasten to your North Star, reset to your North Star, because we wander, we meander. So,
and particularly as an actor, you're asked to do that. You know, so you have to shift a lot. So it's nice to have a place to come back to, you know, to center yourself and have that and regroup. So you can kind of go remind yourself who I am so I can feed it into the next project. You know, you got to get back to neutral before you go back into drive.
Absolutely. That's it. Exactly. Sir, this was such a pleasure. I really appreciate having you on. This was.
Oh, thanks, David.
This was fun to go through. So
good. I really enjoyed it. I love the show and I love what you do. And thank you so much for keeping it alive and celebrating it the way it deserves to be.
Well, I appreciate you, Patrick. I thank you for sharing so much of yourself and for exploring this character and just being here with us. So thank you for your time, sir.
All righty.
I'll be in touch with you. Be well.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye
now. Summer.
Bye, Summer. Patrick McKenna, everyone. Jay Felger in Stargate SG-1. What a cool guy. Thank you so much for tuning in. I appreciate my moderators for making this every episode possible. Really could not pull this off without my team, Summer, Tracy, Anthony, Jeremy, and Reese. You guys make the show possible week in and week out. My thanks to Frederick Marcoux at Concepts Web. He's my web developer who keeps dialthegate.com up and running. If you go to dialthegate.com, we've got 9 upcoming shows that are planned. 3 or 4 of them now have dates. Go over there and keep an eye on what's going to be coming down the pipe. Some of these I'm really, really excited. I mean, I'm excited about all of them, but some of these I'm really excited about. So, and thank you to my producer, Linda Gate Gabber Fury, for continuing to be my stick and rudder and continue to help me churn out these episodes as we go into this super extended third season. We've got a few more to go. So we're gonna get those out to you. My name is David Reed for Dial the Gate. I appreciate you tuning in, and we will see you on the other side. Dial the Gate is hosted and executive produced by David Reed. The producer is Darren Sumner. Co-produced by Linda Fury. The composer is Neil Acree. Animations by Bryce Orrs. The production assistant is Jennifer Kirby. Moderators include Summer Roy, Keith Homel, Tracy Noller, Jeremy Heiner,
Reese M., and Anthony Rowling. Logo design by Deborah J. Bell. Additional effects by Thomas Tots, with contributions by model makers Chris Baker, Stephen Barr, Kevin Zabo, and Tom Paris. The archivists are Linda Fury, Zachary Adams, and Fred Eric Marcoux. For general inquiries for submissions, please contact us at dialthegateshow@gmail.com. Visit our website for the upcoming schedule, as well as an archive of our past episodes at dialthegate.com.